Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is Armin Navabi. Armin, how are you today?
Good.
Right? Okay, so, all right, so we are going to get right into it. Okay, today there's a new book out called Wayward by the actress and author now, Alice Gretchen, and I've been following her for a while. She's got an incredible story, and I read the book. And it's, you know, her story is just absolutely phenomenal. So, you know, we're really, really glad to have her on here to talk about it. Alice is an actress. She's an author. She grew up in a fundamentalist Christian family I guess she'll talk about it more and more as we get there. You had plans, Alice, to become a missionary nurse. You ultimately ended up becoming an actress in Hollywood, and you eventually shed your faith to become a rationalist and a skeptic. Alice also runs Dare to Doubt, which is a foundation that I guess you'll talk about that later as well. And your new book is called Wayward, a memoir of spiritual warfare and sexual purity. And it's coming out in February, early February. So welcome, Alice, to the show. I'm really glad to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my absolute pleasure.
So let's start from this. You know, so you grew up in a fundamentalist Christian family, and it says, for the description of your book, it says your parents felt called by God to exchange worldly employment for heavenly provision, and they followed their faith into homelessness with five children and a cat in tow. So, you know, you wrote about this in the book, but so there was a point when they were employed and they became more and more religious as time went on, or was it always like that? How did everything start?
So how did everything start? So by the time I was born, both of my parents were very much Christians, but they also had, I guess you could say, pretty normal jobs. My father was a police officer at UC Berkeley, California, for a number of years. And my mother was a concert pianist turned piano teacher around the time that she had me. I'm the oldest of five, so I was their first kid. And this was, I was born in 86. So just to give a little time context, when I was nine in the mid 90s, the spiritual renewal movement kind of swept over the world. And today, a lot of people would refer to it as the Toronto Blessing. In my childhood, we referred to it as the Renewal. Some people called it the Father's Blessing. Basically, it was a charismatic revival movement that was spreading across churches, started in Toronto, Canada, eventually went worldwide. And that was really what galvanized my parents' faith and led to intense mystical experiences that they had. Ultimately inspired them to live out their faith in a more, I guess you could say, literal way, and really trust in God completely to provide for all our needs, from housing to clothes to food, and letting go of our things. I remember my dad saying that he used to think he owned his things and realized his things owned him. And in the Bible, Jesus talks a lot about disciples. You have to renounce all your worldly possessions, and then you can be a true follower and come follow me. And I think my parents found a lot of inspiration in that.
Right. So, and what was it like just growing up? So, you know, a big part of your book is you being a girl, right? And going through just regular things that are happening to girls that grow up. So, you know, the title, you have sexual purity as part of the subtitle. And that's a really, really big thing. And I was actually really struck by how, and I mentioned this to you before, that just simple everyday things that most of us take for granted seem to weigh just really, really heavy on you day to day. right? Like, you know, you talk actually very openly about, you know, when you got your period, or, you know, reading romance novels and all of those day-to-day things that just became huge burdens for you as you went on. So why did you decide to be really open and talk about that aspect of it so prominently in your book?
That's a great question. I think because, oh man, you should see the deleted scenes, the scenes that didn't make it into the final cut of the book. I was like, me and my editors were like, oh, maybe there's a bit too much period happening. I'm very open about it because I think, you know, in the type of Christianity that I was raised in, there was such, which the media would call evangelical and I grew up calling non-denominational. There's such an emphasis on sexual purity for boys and girls. But girls were, my impression, what I remember feeling taught is that we had to be the gatekeepers of sexual purity. We were taught that boys and men would always be after us and it was up to us. And we were also taught that, and I mentioned this in the book, there's no purity test for males like there is for females, because there's so much emphasis on the hymen and on virginal blood being spilled on a wedding night, both in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. These Abrahamic faiths, there's so much emphasis on virginity as being the ultimate focal point of a woman's worth and or girl. I'm going to use those interchangeably, basically, because we all know, you know, girls too young to marry do. And I think that when they're placed in the role of womanhood, they deserve to be called a woman. But that's my personal opinion, just for everything they have to endure. But anyway, I chose to be very open and candid about that, not just periods, but masturbation. The romance novels that you mentioned, they turned me on. And I realized later that was my version of pornography. And I thought, like, oh, porn is so dirty and only boys and men struggle with that. But I felt like God convicted me of my literary pornography. And so it was a sin I felt like I really struggled with, because who doesn't love getting off? And I think that it's a very relatable thing. And so that's why I chose to be open about it, because with the period and stuff, it's just something that most females go through. And for me, within the context that I grew up in, getting my period meant it was symbolic of that transition into womanhood, where now I had to be, I couldn't get away with being an innocent girl anymore. I had to be responsible. It also meant that I was, in a biblical sense, it meant that I was eligible for marriage, even though my parents would never have given me away at 12 years old to be married. I was 12 when I got my period, but it, in my mind, from everything that I'd gleaned from reading the Bible and my own interpretations of things, it just, getting my period did become such a huge burden. Not only is it physically inconvenient and painful, but for me, in my mind, it just, there was so much weight attached to it, because it just symbolized the burden of responsibility that I now had as being a sexual person who was capable of procreating, needing to make extra sure that I didn't attract male attention. And I wanted to be candid about it because I know it's something that a lot of girls go through. I don't know what it's like to be a guy, obviously, but, and I'm sure you guys have your own version of epiphanies that you have to experience when you go through puberty and your own experiences within purity culture. But yeah, I'm quite candid about mine.
Yeah. I think it's very different. I mean, of course, you know, there are boys who go through, they're raised in these Abrahamic religions. They're made to feel guilty about any number of things because just these religions, they're completely obsessed with sexual purity, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why I think, you know, it made it into your book and so prominently as well. But what do you think it is about, like, the obsession with virginity and especially women's sexual purity, starting from Mary, right? That she had to be a virgin, because if she wasn't, because God forbid, you know, a penis ever touched her, then, you know, the whole Jesus thing wouldn't be as amazing. And she was innocent, she was chaste, you know, you lose your virginity, you lose your virginity, you're losing something rather than gaining a new part of your life. Even the way that we talk about it, you know, words like deflowering and all, there's so much language, and it's pervasive. Even for people who leave their faith, they still have these stigmas. So I can see that you want to push back against that in a really, really big way. But it's a massive undertaking to do that, right? And you know, talking about it is one thing, but what do you think it is about these religions? Why do they try to focus so much on the sexual purity, especially for women and girls?
So my personal take on it, and I'm just speaking candidly because I appreciate this question, and it's one that I've thought about but have not articulated, I think, quite in public before. So my personal take is I think that a lot of these religions we're talking about are very patriarchal, and it's my personal opinion that I think the men who originated a lot of these ideas and the cultures that they were born in are very threatened by the power of female sexuality and female creatorship, because I don't know when it was that we realized it took one sperm and one egg to make a baby, but women have had the burden and honor of being able to carry that baby to fruition. And I think that I've always wondered if maybe there's some sort of unconscious cultural jealousy about that, of women being the life givers, if you will, even though we all know we need two parts. We need both. I think that it's partly that. I think men are threatened by women's ability to create. And I think that, like I said earlier, boys and men don't have a hymen. There's no way to prove their sexual innocence or lack thereof. And of course, now we know that there are many ways for a hymen to be broken. And some girls are just born without one. So virginity tests, which are prevalent in so many cultures and belief systems, I think that it's just easier to blame a girl for not bleeding than it is to try to find fault with a boy. And I think women, obviously being generally speaking the weaker sex in a physical sense, women tend to be smaller and not as strong as men. I think it's something that I'm definitely curious to study more, and I'm fascinated by it. I'm fascinated by just multiple cultures' obsession with female virginity, especially when it's not a valid way to gauge blood on sheets is not a valid way to gauge someone's sexual experience or lack thereof. I think what you asked is a very good question. Like, why are religions and cultures so obsessed with sexual purity, and especially that of girls and women? I guess the honest answer is I don't know, but I can only surmise that I think that sex is more powerful than any idea of God. Otherwise, why would it be so persecuted? Why would it be like the number one thing, at least my impression, the number one thing that religions fixate on, from everything to how people dress, to words they can and can't use, to where you sit and where you can eat at the table and who eats first. I think the gender roles and especially how they pertain to sex, I don't know exactly how or why women came to bear the brunt of that, because I don't think ancient spiritual practices and belief systems were so patriarchal. There's so much evidence from prehistory that the belief in the feminine divine, you might say, was more dominant than a male divine. At least archaeologically speaking, the evidence suggests that with female figurines and such.
Mm-hmm. I know Armin's been having connection issues, but Armin, do you have a question?
Yeah, no. I was just going to mention one answer might be, I read this book by Dr. Daryl Ray a long time ago, so I don't know if I remember it correctly, but one theory is
the title of the book, just for the people.
Oh yeah. Sex and God by Dr. Daryl Ray. I think one theory is because sex is such an important part of our identity and also something that we constantly think about, it makes complete strategic sense for religion to try to weaponize that and use it as a way so that religion becomes constantly on your mind, right? Especially by asking you, by telling you that you are sinful and you're doing something disgusting, and asking you to do, to have abide by some purity test that is designed, like, not on purpose, but just through survival of the memes, was designed to make sure that you do fail at achieving that purity test, to passing that purity test, so that you do, then you need the religion for purification, because you understand that there's something wrong with you, there's something sinful about you, and the only way out is through the cleansing that the religion offers. And maybe that's one of the reasons why it's so obsessed about telling you. It's not telling you that you're not supposed to do certain things like masturbation, because it's trying to stop you from masturbating. It's trying to, it knows you're going to fail. Like, I'm using the word "no" loosely. It just seems like it knows that you're going to fail and that you're going to need the institution to come and purify you. But that's one theory, I think.
Yes, I would 100% agree with that. And I've come across that too, that theory. And thank you for bringing that up, because I might agree with that more than my own theories. I think that there's lots of theories that work in conjunction together. And I think that the perpetuating of that shame cycle, if you make wrong something that is so deeply instinctive to being human, and you perpetuate shame around it and tell people that the only way to absolve yourself of the sin, of that shame, is to repent and become dependent on the belief system. Yeah, it's a brilliant marketing strategy. Genius.
Yeah, it's totally Machiavellian. Like, I used to think when I was younger, and, you know, so I grew up in Saudi Arabia, and it seemed like whenever men, you mentioned that, you know, the women are thought of as the weaker sex. So, you know, men, for their strength and their physical power, right, which they didn't do anything to earn, it's just something that they're, you know, they're biologically ingrained with, they're rewarded for it. You know, the blood, sweat, and tears, you know, when you go and you put work into it and you're putting the muscles in, you've got grease marks and sweat everywhere, then you've made a good day's living, right? But with women who tend to have, I guess, more sexual power, in a way, like that's the thing that has been such a big threat, and reproductive power, right? The idea of, you know, childbearing, the gift of childbearing, they have all of that. They're made to feel shame about it. So if they decide to use it for any purpose that they want or any way that they want to, then they're immediately slammed for it. It's just a way for them to, the patriarchal religions, I think, to control women, because they knew that it was that men are very, very vulnerable to this, you know, as a threat. At the same time, they use it as temptation. You've got the 72 virgins in heaven, in paradise, in Islam, right? They use that. They recruit teenage kids who are going through puberty, like 14, 15 years old. And it's, you know, and they live in segregated societies where they can't really see the girls or interact with, you know, the other sex. So you tell them, hey, you know, you can go and you can blow yourself up and you'll immediately have all of these virgins for you. And again, you know, virgins. It's really interesting. I think there are many reasons. One of the commenters also talked about paternity, and that's an obvious one as well, making sure that your children are your own. I'll read out Lois's comment here. She says, the basic concept of evolution, the characteristics of those who got their genes into the next generation were passed on. Males had trouble being sure that the offspring were their own. So those who...
I don't know if that the idea of making sure that these are your children is a biological thing. I do think that might be something that society introduced later. I don't know how much of it is like, but I have a question though. Do you have any experience before and after, like being in your religion, previous religion, about the bias between how sex shaming is done on boys versus girls, both growing up and also later as adults?
Are you asking, have I learned much about, like, the differences of the lasting ramifications?
No, for example, I noticed that even as atheists, right, I think the effect of sex shaming is still, we carry that with us after we leave our religion. But in interesting ways, in that even as people who are claim to be sex positive, there seems to be more tolerance towards, for example, men experimenting and being with multiple partners, and, you know, doing, for example, even like if you ask, for example, fathers, right, who are not even religious anymore, if they would be comfortable with their son having many, many sex partners. I think a lot of some fathers would be like, yeah, that would be even proud of their son for being able to. I mean, the word that is used is usually a player, right? Player is usually considered to be a positive word, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody that has managed to achieve something. But again, as a non-religious atheist father, if you ask them the same thing about their daughter, they would all of a sudden feel very uncomfortable about having a daughter that has experimented a lot and has many sexual partners and just is known for going around and being very easy, the word that they use, or like the other word that people often think of when they think of a woman that has many sexual partners is the word slut, which is, unlike the word player, seems to be used more often as a as a negative. But so I don't know if we could associate this bias with religion's upbringing, or is it culture, or is it culture being influenced by religion? I don't know what are your thoughts on that. And have you noticed that also as when you were religious and then later, like, how was it different? Yeah. So what do you expect?
Yeah, I think I understand. I think what I hear you saying is addressing the sexual double standards that still exist even in the secular world, even with people who are not even formally religious. I guess two thoughts came to mind as I was listening to your question. I do think that even secular society is still very deeply shaped by our more recent religions in the past, like 6-10,000 years. I still think that a lot of the remnants of what we might call purity culture still bleed over into a secular society. And I think that comes from just even if someone's not raised religious their whole life, say they're born into an atheist household, but they grow up in America or Canada, someplace very, very Western. I still think that because Canada and America were founded by people who did tend to believe in Christianity, I think it's so deeply rooted in our culture that it's become a little bit difficult to distinguish religion and culture in that sense and other senses. The second thing that I would say to that as to why maybe a parent might be more concerned about their daughter having more sexual partners than a boy is, I do think that there is something, I would argue that there's a biological reason for that too, that's maybe not conscious, but I think that females we have higher stakes. The consequences are higher for us having more sexual partners because there's pregnancy, number one. And I think even if this is not necessarily conscious and a parent's either approval or disapproval of how many sexual partners their child has, I do think that on a base level, we just know that it's going to cost a girl physically, financially, educationally, we know it's going to cost her more. The risk of sex is higher, I think, for women because there's the risk of pregnancy. And I would say that would be the more religion-stripped thought that I have about that. I think like what you suggested, the intermingling of how religion does shape cultures. It's difficult for me to imagine a culture without religion. Does that answer
partially? Yes, very much.
I think for myself, like I definitely still see with people that I've talked to who also grew up very very religiously, whether it was Mormonism or even Scientology, which most religions have some sort of opinion about sex. it's interesting for me always to talk to the men who have left and understand better how purity cultures affected them, because there's lots of literature on how purity cultures affected women, especially, at least what I've personally come across, especially in ex-Christian and ex-Muslim circles. But there's not as much data as to how it's affected men. I think a lot of the symptoms for women are more obvious, like vaginismus, for instance, when sex is extremely painful because you've spent so many years dissociating yourself that even when you do get married and try to have sex, you physically can't, or it's just extremely painful and difficult. I think that there's just a lot more objective and quantifiable data for women and how it's affected them than there is men that I've found, but we all know it's there. Guy friends of mine who were raised very religiously, who are not anymore, I've asked them in private conversations, and for them, the common theme that I hear the most is just overwhelming shame. Even though they're so split from that belief system now, they still struggle with so much shame for their sexual attraction or their desires or their fantasy or their porn life, whatever it is. Even shame for how they react to slutty women now, even though they are absolutely for women having sex and will have sex with these women, there's still this wiring that I've heard a lot of them struggle with like finding out how many partners a girlfriend has and being turned off by it, simultaneously knowing that that's their programming that they don't subscribe to anymore, but feeling helpless to change that aversion.
Yeah.
I'm sorry,
go ahead, Armin.
I remember that shame very vividly because the way we were brought up is to, as we were told that God could see our mind, like see what we're thinking. And the problem with the God that I was taught to believe is that he's not just a tyrant of your actions, he's also a tyrant of your thoughts, right? So you could be sinning not because of you're doing something, not because you're looking at a woman, not because you're talking to a woman, not because you're watching porn or anything like that. You could just be having ugly like thoughts. And like, so going through my teenage years, I remember every single time something like that crossed my mind, I feel so disgusted. I feel like God is watching me. I thought like so ungrateful, so low, and I kept praying and begging for forgiveness and saying so unworthy of having so much blessings from God. And instead of being thankful, instead of showing appreciation, I'm failing to do the most basic things that are asked of me. And how disgusting and vile do I have to be to even have such thoughts like this? Like, how could I be so pathetically weak to fail so miserably? I could remember and constantly begging God and promising that this will not happen again, and it constantly happened again. So I remember that a lot. I know what you're referring to. But Ali, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I think that a lot of this also, especially in Middle Eastern culture, you know, what I saw, it's still pervasive, and I think it's actually pervasive all over the world, is just the idea of thinking of women as property. You know, your daughters, you know, you don't want them, you know, to be subject to other men. You know, you're going to cover your wife because, you know, you don't want other men to look at her. And I sort of disagree, I think, with Armin in that I do think that the paternity aspect, like knowing that your kids are yours, you know, because you had heirs, you had emperors and you had kings and everything, and they wanted to make sure that they passed it on to their, we've all seen Game of Thrones, right? And rooted in some element of historical reality. So
Ali, your mic is constantly touching your
Sorry, I forgot to hold it up. So I think that, you know, this idea of property, even the word husband, right? You know, about animal husbandry, you know, what they do is like they manage cattle and goats, and the dowry system, you know, paying for a woman, and the younger she is, the more virginal she is, the higher the dowry is. So there's all these, just historically, a lot of this really points to, you know, women being the property of men, which is, you know, just a hallmark of patriarchal societies. And, you know, that's why you have a double standard when it comes to your daughters versus your sons, when it comes to the sexual aspect of it and the sexual purity too. I think that that's one point that Lois brought up and some of the other people brought up that has some merit. But I wanted to get, unless you wanted to say something about that,
Well, you know, it's interesting, and this is sort of unrelated, but also very much related. I read somewhere, and I cannot for the life of me remember if it was in Christopher Ryan's Sex at Dawn, all about how humans are not hardwired for monogamy. There's no evidence for that, actually. I can't remember if it was there or if it was in a fictional series called Clan of the Cave Bear. I was reading both around the same time, but so forgive my lack of being able to accurately source this, but I remember coming across a theory that, like I was saying earlier, a lot of prehistorical belief systems did seem very female deity centered. And there's a theory that that changed when men realized that one man could father a child, and you didn't need multiple men to sleep with the same woman to ensure that she would reproduce. You only needed one man to do that. And when men could realize that they, their power of the contribution to creating life, they became more possessive of it. I don't know if I'm phrasing this accurately, but I do think that theory, wherever I came across it, it stuck with me, in the sense that that kind of makes sense, especially if resources were scarce and you needed to provide for a limited amount of kids. Maybe it kind of makes sense that you'd want to make sure they're yours. I could empathize with that perspective. But I think Christopher Ryan mentions in Sex at Dawn that women in some places, they used to be encouraged to sleep with multiple men within the same tribe, because the idea was that the child would get different aspects from all of the different men. Some might get this man's sense of humor, this man's hunting skills. And when we realize that, you just need the one, maybe that's when proprietorship took hold and patriarchy therefore took hold. I think that that's a very interesting theory that that I'm grateful some people are exploring, and I love to read the occasional book or article about it, because it's fascinating.
Yeah, I think Sex at Dawn was a great book, because I remember he talked about a lot of these sort of evo psych concepts where it was actually the females that were promiscuous, because they would, even the, we call it female copulatory vocalizations, like the noises they make, that was a signal to other males in the area to come, and they would let all of the males duke it out to get the best genes. It was like an evolutionary thing there too. And so I thought that was really interesting, that it wasn't just, you know, they say, well, this monogamy is unnatural for males. A lot of people think it's just for men, but historically, it was actually, and we're finding out more and more, right, as there's more sexual empowerment among women, that it's not just, promiscuity is not just a man thing, right? It's both. A lot of this is socialization. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. Armin?
I do think it makes a lot of strategic sense. I mean, not morally, but strategically, for the sex that has more physical power, and at a time especially where physical power means more control, to allow as many partners for itself as it wants, but also make the other sex treat the other sex like a commodity, where it could collect as many of it, as much as it has control, as much as power it has, to be able to collect as many of it as possible, and to also remove the access of other competing, male individuals to have access to her by suggesting that she is only his and no one else's. This is my product, my commodity, and nobody gets to own it but me. Which makes me wonder if things would be exactly the same, but from the other side, if women had more physically they were stronger, I would argue that they would probably do the exact same thing to men if they were stronger, but I don't know.
It's definitely interesting to think about. I've definitely thought, like, I wonder if what would history and therefore today look like if both sexes were more just physically equal, because we're just not. For the most part, we're just not. And that's just the cold, hard physical truth. And just from a strictly biological standpoint, like there's like, what is equal when we're talking about biology? But I'm very grateful for at least intellectual equality to be, I'm a very grateful participant in the intellectual equality that I, as a privileged American woman, get to experience. And I'm very deeply sympathetic to those who still don't have that yet.
Yeah. I do want to get back to your life and some of the experiences that you went through, but this conversation just got really, really, it's just really interesting. I mean, you're bringing up a lot of really interesting stuff. But I sometimes even think the things that we value, because right now they're talking about a lot of women having STEM careers and so on. Like, that's great. But why did we start valuing STEM over other things? Like over, there's like this idea that, what about raising kids, teaching about relationships, how to connect with people. If you talk to people who are dying in nursing homes or in ICUs, the number one thing they say is, I wish I had better relationships. And if that is what quality of life is, then why do we value, what made us start valuing the aspects of life that just make us engage in the rat race and try to achieve as much as possible before we all die and don't take any of our bank accounts with us,
Oh gosh. Yes.
Even that aspect of it, it makes you wonder about, just the kind of things that we put value on. But these are just interesting questions. I don't think we're going to end up answering them all.
I love these questions. This is the type of stuff that I could talk about for hours on end. So yeah, we can very easily go off on tangents, but I'll let you guys as the host guide this. But I'm very much enjoying this discussion is what I mean to say.
Okay. That's
fine. Doesn't have to be all about my book.
But I think a lot of this stuff is related to your book, because your book highlights this idea, like, what do we value about women? What we don't value about women. But so I wanted to ask you, with your story, is that you had plans to become a missionary nurse, mm-hmm. right? And then you got this opportunity to go to Hollywood and become an actress. So that's obviously a really big transition. And so, as if that's not enough, ultimately you also give up the religion and you become a skeptic. How did your family, your parents, what's your relationship with them like? What was it like before? What is it like now? And your siblings as well? How did they react to it? How did they process all of this?
Oh man. So as you know from reading the book, and what I'm always happy to share whenever I can, is my parents are both incredibly open to learning and changing people. I think that it would be very easy for someone to read my book and want to villainize them, the way I've villainized parents of other memoirs that I've read of children who had unconventional or difficult upbringings. I feel very, very lucky that even when I did leave my faith, that my parents still loved me and chose to keep me in their life. It was never I never had to fear abandonment. I feared judgment for sure. I feared conversations I didn't want to have, but I didn't have to worry about my family not talking to me, never mind possibly even harming me or killing me over leaving my faith. So I first and foremost, I commend my parents for the growth that they've done individually and together, not just for me, but for all. Like I said, I'm the oldest of five, and my four siblings, they all have their own journeys too. And none of us believe in God. We're all atheists or agnostics, certainly not the way my parents raised us to be. But my parents, they don't even really consider themselves Christians anymore. But this did not happen overnight, as it rarely does for most people, and especially I think older people who have grown children. As growing up, my parents were very, very strict, both within their belief system and outside of it. Like, even within our Christian circles, my parents were stricter than most in terms of what my siblings and I could watch, what we could listen to. But they weren't as strict as some other kids that I went to church with. The main church that I grew up in when I was really little had families where the girls couldn't wear pants. They had to wear long skirts or dresses. So my parents let us wear pants. I wore leggings and jeans as a kid. But you know, I couldn't see Fern Gully, for instance, or Jumanji, or anything that might have demonic or magical undertones. I can't remember Jumanji. The reason for that. Or I couldn't see Home Alone because it might inspire rebellion, a kid like on the loose. So my parents were very strict in their own way, but very liberal and radical in other ways. Like people are always surprised. I moved to Los Angeles when I was 16. I turned 17 within weeks of moving here. And at 17 years old, my parents let me stay. And people are always like, your parents were so strict. How did they let you do that? How did they leave their 17-year-old daughter alone in a big city in Hollywood with such a staunch Christian right background? And the simplest way that I found to answer that is through the lens of God. I think they, as well as I at the time, very deeply believed that the opportunity to be an actress in Hollywood was a door God was opening. It wasn't something that I sought out on my own. If I had, maybe the response would have been different. If I just decided I want to be an actress and model and, you know, I'm done with purity culture. I'm done with all of this, you know, like I want to move to LA and make it on my own in a big city, in a very hedonistic industry that over-sexualizes people, to one could argue. So it's like the very opposite of everything that I grew up in many ways. But the opportunity came to me. You mentioned that I was training to be a missionary nurse. So I was homeschooled my whole life, which meant that I was in college by the time I was 15 and got my GED at 16. And I felt like nursing and being a missionary were what God called me to. And simultaneously, I had been approached at different points throughout my teenagehood to be a model. And I didn't, I was very split about it, because what person doesn't like being told you're attractive, you know, but there was also so much guilt and shame around being told that you're attractive enough to like make a living at it. It's a weird thing to digest, especially when there's so much shame around A, just being female, and knowing that carrying the burden of being something that people will be attracted to and that it's wrong. Never mind going into an industry where it's all about that, because modeling was how I got into acting. Long story short, at 15, one of the talent scout, 15 or 16, one of the talent scouts who approached me at a shopping mall, so cliche, but true. At that point in my life, I was trying to think, how am I going to pay to fund my way through nursing school? And me and my parents thought maybe modeling is a way that God's going to provide the money for me to continue on with nursing school and eventually mission school. I was going to join YWAM, which is Youth with a Mission. It's a very big Christian missionary organization. And they have basically like a, I guess you could call it like a health department. I don't know. I thought maybe I might join Mercy Ships ultimately, which is like Doctors Without Borders, but Christian. And so that was kind of my goal. And so I was like, all right, maybe I'll do modeling for a little bit. And then through my modeling agency, this was in Colorado, I got scouted by a talent manager from LA, and the doors to nursing closed. At the time I looked at everything through a very spiritual lens. And so everything had significance and life didn't just happen. It was obviously God opening or closing a door. So when I couldn't pursue nursing anymore because of my age, you have to be 18 in Colorado to graduate from nursing school. Simultaneously, the door to acting opened up. And so I walked through the door and, I started working as an actress pretty much right away within my first year. And so I took it as a sign from God that, at least for the time being, he wanted me to stay here. And again, I told myself, maybe this is how he's going to provide the money for me to go back to nursing school when I am old enough, or give me more of a, today we'd use the term platform. I don't think the term platform certainly wasn't my lexicon back then, but being an actor model could give me a platform essentially to, open up the hospital I dreamed of opening and marry a good Christian doctor was this whole fantasy I had in my head. None of that happened. I'm still here almost 20 years later.
Yes. Go ahead, Armin.
I heard this from a couple of other former religious women. I wonder if it's true with you as well. I've been told like there's a guilt associated with enjoying being told that you're pretty. Like, mm-hmm. was that something like there? Like somebody telling people constantly telling you that you look good, you look pretty, and then. Liking that feeling that you get from other people acknowledging that, and then followed up right after by guilt that of the fact that you're enjoying that. Is that something you experienced?
Yes, I deeply relate to that, and I write about that too. It was such a mind fuck, honestly, because of course the ego is flattered by being told flattering things, and simultaneously there was just so much shame around it. In my book, I write about how I got my first modeling portfolio, a book of pictures that I would take with me to castings, and I didn't even recognize myself in the photo. I thought it was another girl's book that got mixed up for mine because I'd never seen myself that way. This was before cell phones had cameras. I never saw pictures of myself really like that. My family pictures, sure, but didn't. And I was so overcome with shame, I couldn't even look at my portfolio when it was handed to me. I had to wait until I was home in the privacy of my bedroom, and I cried because I could tell, like, she's a beautiful girl, this girl in the pictures. Like, she could. And even now, it feels so weird to say that. It sounds so self-aggrandizing, but that's how it felt. And I immediately turned to my Bible, which thus far I'd mainly focused on the verses of how women should not dress. Do not adorn your hair with gold and pearls, and you know, don't encourage lust is ultimately it. So don't beautify yourself. Don't make yourself attractive and lust worthy. And I consoled myself the way I've heard other Christian or ex-Christian models, actors, whatever, have consoled themselves by referring to the story of Queen Esther in the Bible, who was this beautiful virgin that the king liked her best out of all the virgins lined up to be the next queen. And he was going to like kill a bunch of Jews, and she got herself really pretty and glamorous and gave her husband some wine, and eventually she basically seduced him and told him, if you kill all the Jews, you're going to have to kill me too. Change that. And so the takeaway was that God used Esther's beauty to save his people and to further do God's will. And so that was that's how I justified the looks that I've been born with, the time and place that I've been born into, where it just happens to be in vogue. And bookable as a financial commodity. People want to pay for the way you look. And I was just like, okay, I guess if God didn't want me to do this, he wouldn't have made me this way, and he wouldn't be giving me these opportunities. There was still constantly, and to be honest, probably still to this day, on levels that I both consciously and subconsciously still fight, there's still a lot of wrestling that I've had to deal with over the years. Even again, in secular society, whether it's based in religion or stands on its own as a cultural thing, people like you to, there's so many mixed messages, especially now with the body positivity movement. There's all these messages to like, love the skin you're in, on an advertisement for something to alter the way you look. It's very confusing. And there's a lot of guilt and shame about our desire to be beautiful and the pressure to not be vain. Don't be conceited about your beauty, but aspire to beauty. I don't know. It's confusing.
It's actually what's interesting. Like while you're talking about this, Alice, like I noticed that you're still a little hesitant about it. I don't want to be too self-aggrandizing. I don't want to see that, you know, admitting that everybody has their strengths and this is your profession. This is where you are. And everybody knows, right, what you look like. So but it seems like you still feel a little self-conscious about taking ownership of it. And I kind of know this because my ex is a boudoir photographer, like professionally, that's what she does. And a lot of the clients that she has are people from really conservative religious backgrounds. And they come in when they see their books, right? That when she finalizes their photos and they see it, she's made like loads of videos, testimonial videos of it, and they start bawling, they start crying because they're like, "Is that me?" And she's like, "Yeah, that looks totally like you." Like, well, I can't, but no, this girl's beautiful. What I'm seeing in the picture, it's not. So it's, I've actually heard a lot of stories about that just from being exposed to that.
I don't think
it is a very conflicting message, you know. So it's, and the biblical story you told, it's again, it's about the, like the sexual power or the physical power of women. And that for some reason is just, it seems completely shameful. It's like so ingrained. Whereas, you know, if somebody wanted to compliment me for the physical power that I have, which I don't really have a whole lot of, you know, in terms of lifting weights or, you know, being able to do, you know, Armin has a lot of it. You got abs, right, Armin? You can do it. Yeah. But yeah, then that is a sense of virtue. I mean, we would totally own it. Like the men completely own it. Like there's no hesitation. I mean, take off your shirt and, you know, put yourself on Instagram. It's like easy. It's the first thing I would do if I had a body. I wouldn't dissociate myself from that image. It's really, really fascinating. The whole story is really fascinating.
Katie actually had a comment regarding this. And then, why do you think, even as atheists, we answered this, but I just wanted to read it because there was she mentioned, "I have seen several atheists who don't mind men showing their abs and being hot, but women being sexual is considered porno." In a negative way. Yeah. So yeah, we already answered this, but I just wanted to highlight that because, by the way, the story of Esther is a story about our people, the Persians, wanting to kill all the Jews. I don't know if you know that, but that's used as a lot of Persians use this as a story to be a bit anti-Semitic because they're like the chief minister of the king was this evil Persian guy who was supposed to kill all the Jews, and Esther with her came up with a plan how to stop the king, and Haman was killed instead of the Jews. That story is a conflict between some Persians. And there's this, I don't know, in Israel, there is a celebration behind the killing of Haman, which is this Persian guy. So I don't know if you know about that, but that's very interesting as well.
I'm always fascinated by the parallels. And that's one of the things that I got a lot from reading your book, Ali, the Atheist Muslim, was just like, oh, wow. Like I've read snippets of the Quran and I've knew snippets of Islam. But of course, since starting Dare to Doubt, I've had to learn a lot more about it. And it's like, I don't know who's plagiarizing who, but there's like just so many parallels, differences, of course, too, obviously. But yeah, I'm always fascinated by that.
Yeah. And the parallels are actually largely, again, they have to do with stuff like foreskin, stuff like Mary and her virginity and that obsession with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the parallels are, it's just really interesting. The parts of things that they've decided to hold on to, mm-hmm. like all of the punishments, mm-hmm. stoning for adultery. Again, as you said, it's a number one thing that, you know, Moses and Muhammad were both pretty much obsessed with.
One of the most consistent things, even beyond Abrahamic religions, is women under periods being somehow cursed or disgusting or something like that. That is so, like, it's one of the least harmful things on the planet, and it's one of the most consistent themes in religion. When it comes to women under period, like in Hinduism, for example. I mean, when it comes, for example, to sex negativity in Hinduism, that's more, I mean, that's a little bit based on the religion itself, but a lot of it is mostly based on their influence of Islam and Christianity on modern Hinduism, right? But that's women and their periods being cursed or something, that is Hinduism. That's like ancient Hinduism, like not even being allowed in the temple. And so I don't know why is everybody so afraid of that? I don't even make sense from a strategic perspective. Why is this something that every religion is so against? I don't understand it. Do you understand?
I don't either. The thought that comes to my mind when I consider it is like, I know at least, in the Bible, like the Old and New Testament, blood is a big deal. Like, God is very explicit for how to shed blood in terms of sacrifices and like what animals you can eat and what you can't. And like, there's a lot of blood. And so maybe women's blood is just, I don't know why it got so demonized, but it certainly wasn't viewed as a good thing, we all know. And I don't know, it just seemed like, just seems like blood is a big deal overall. Animal blood, human blood, female blood. And yeah, I would love to know more about the history of how women's blood came to be such this unclean thing. When it is, I mean, yeah, no one likes to be covered in blood, but it's, so I guess in that sense, it's dirty, but it's also just so, it's so natural, and can be managed. It's not like you just have to like bleed out everywhere. It's very manageable. I don't understand that either.
Yeah, but it must make some strategic sense, because this whole thing being a curse seems to be, I mean, maybe I'm incorrect, but this, somebody could educate me, but it seems to have independently different religions came to this as well. Like, so it must make some strategic sense if they're not even copying each other and coming to this conclusion. I'm not sure about that, though. But go on, Alice, you wanted to say something?
You know, I feel like I read somewhere someone addressing this, and it had to do with maybe contamination. Like, we didn't understand the science of germs necessarily, or how contamination spread. But I remember reading something about how, why Jews can't eat pork, why there's like kosher, that's the word. Someone was saying how maybe that stemmed not so much from, they spiritualized it and framed it in religious terms, but on a biological level, maybe people knew that mixing certain foods or certain meats with others, or hanging certain meats above, like there was dripping of blood on certain things, and all people knew was they got sick. And maybe they didn't have the science to explain how and why that happened, but somewhere certain types of blood became associated with contamination. And maybe that's why, just from a rational perspective, maybe there's something to the theory that women's blood might contaminate.
Just for the record, when I say strategic, I'm not saying justified, because strategic is usually rational for the survival of the meme, I'm not saying it's good for the society or for the happiness of the individuals in a society. It's mostly just for the survival of the ideology and the meme itself. So that's what I mean by strategic. I do have a question. Do you still deal with shame from time to time? Because I try to brag about how sex positive I am, but even I sometimes notice something happens or somebody says something that I keep like, ooh, I haven't felt this feeling for like a decade. Like, I just see it like pop back up. There's just a little bit like, ooh, I remember this feeling. Ooh, hello, I miss you. Like that shame and that guilt, like, just sometimes comes up. Do you sometimes have to deal with that?
Yes. As Ali just pointed out, I'm still flustered talking about just how I came to modeling and acting. I still feel self-conscious, and it could be easy to mistake it for feigned modesty. No, I genuinely have like hot flushes going through my body talking about this. And I think that, there's part of me that can be very rational, objective of like, oh no, this is just, like I said, I was just made this way. And I just happened to be born into an era where this is just the thing, and it can be monetized. There is still an emotional part of me that's like still struggles with shame about not wanting to appear like I'm tooting my own horn, or that I'm trying to rub it in anyone's face. And I think a lot of that still comes from the shame that is still here in the secular world from women to women, for many reasons of like, don't like messages that I've internalized of like, don't rub your skinniness in other women's faces. Not everyone can eat a hamburger like you. So don't eat that like so happily in front of me when I can't, cause I'm on a diet. There's shame in that level too, of like knowing how undeservedly lucky one might be genetically, and how people can be threatened or jealous of that. It's definitely there outside of religion. So I think it's difficult for me to discern where the wires are getting crossed, how much of my shame around being considered attractive is still from my religious upbringing, and how much of it is just from society going, just being what it is. And, you know, I could argue evolutionally, like, of course, there's mating competition. Like, there's so many ways we could dissect this. But yes, ultimately, I do still struggle with it. Sometimes I do I can definitely trace it to religious origin, as opposed to secular culture origin, as secular as culture can be, as we've discussed. Yeah, it's an icky feeling.
It's weird that it's kind of interesting, because I'm just thinking of men who have that, like their physical character, like if they are as physically blessed, like it's monetized without any issue. Like it's really interesting seeing the differences. Susanna, I know, is going to absolutely want to talk to you and individually, and she should actually, like, it would be, I would totally watch that conversation. It'd be interesting because she's commenting and she's saying she's the same girl. Everything that you're saying, she's completely relating to. I've never, you know, seen that. So I'm looking forward to hearing that conversation, but we're kind of out of time. I wanted to give you a minute to just talk about Dare to Doubt, which I think, you know, is an excellent organization. And you established this. I mean, it's the tagline is detaching from harmful belief systems. So it's, you know, sort of helping people doubt and ask questions of their religious beliefs. So can you talk about that a little bit really quickly? Let everybody know how to find it.
Yes. Yeah. So daretodoubt.org. It's a resource site for people beginning to detach from different belief systems that they've come to find harmful. I've tried, my background obviously is, as I stated, is Christianity, but I've also tried to give a starting point of resources for people of other faith backgrounds, including Islam, Judaism, Scientology, Amish, and Eastern religions and inspired groups. I might be Mormonism too, and I'm currently working on building the Jehovah's Witness page of resources, because there's a lot of people exiting the Jehovah's Witness belief system right now, and or at least that's what a lot of the private emails that I've been getting tell me. I've recently had a bunch of Jehovah's Witnesses hitting me up, being like, "Hey, like, do you know where I can get help?" And so now's the time to build that page. Daretodoubt.org. It's far from an exhaustive list of all of the resources that are out there. The criteria that I've tried to use when choosing which resources to highlight basically came down to how user-friendly they were. I personally find resource sites very overwhelming. I'm easily overwhelmed, especially by lots of visual text. I tried to make it easy for someone. I've often said that I built this site for my 21-year-old self, who was extremely fragile, suicidal, and couldn't even Google like therapist in my local area. I had a lot of help, and I was very fortunate to have of people helping me through this. I didn't recognize my symptoms as stemming from religious trauma at the time. I now know it's textbook. The main thing that I wanted to focus on with Dare to Doubt was promoting secular resources, because I think that there's many resources for Christians and other believers in various stages of doubt, often designed to keep them in, to keep them in the fold. And like, there's a lot of therapists who would say that they're spiritual. And I personally was very allergic to that when I was needing therapy. I was in therapy for 3 years following my deconversion. And when I would come across a spiritual therapist, I just had this visceral reaction in my body of like, this person's not trustworthy. I can't really confide in them because they believe in woo-woo stuff that tells me they're not rational thinking and I'm not safe with them. Yes, that's a judgment. And I have very spiritual friends in my life. But when I'm in a vulnerable place and I'm needing help, that's just what I need. And a lot of people need that. A lot of people need a very staunch secular stance in order for themselves to feel safe, trusting their history and themselves with someone. So I really wanted to highlight secular resources with Dare to Doubt. That said, I was a questioning liberal Christian for 3 years after leaving evangelicalism before I became a full-on atheist. And those 3 years were, I was exploring other religions and spiritual paths. And if I had come across a website like Dare to Doubt that was only secular and only atheist and very much condemning of different stages of belief or doubt or spirituality or religion in general, I would have been turned off by it. And I might not have eventually gotten to where I am today. And so I call it faith friendly. And I'm also, and I know a lot of people disagree with me on this, but I also find a lot of evidence to believe that faith is not a choice. I know for me, it wasn't. When I deconverted, I didn't have a choice about that. It was more of an admission, I feel, than a choice. And I also think that the reverse is true for a lot of people, that their belief to believe is not a choice. They just can't help it. They believe there's something more. I feel personally very compassionate to that. And I could get into the biological arguments for that, but we don't have time. So I tried to make Dare to Doubt. I tried to make it very easy to find secular resources there, but I also include some that are more, like I said, I use the term faith friendly because I recognize in personal experience that there are different stages of doubt. And that's not to say that everyone who doubts will become an atheist. Maybe they'll find a healthier expression of spirituality that's just true for them. Because my ultimate goal with Dare to Doubt and anything else is just to encourage people to let go of what is not true for them and embrace what is. And that can fluctuate. It did for me. I expect it will continue. As long as you have peace inside yourself, that even if you're falling on a sword, it's your own sword and no one else's, you're living for you. I think that's more the ultimate message that I would like, because I think it can be just as dangerous to, and could backfire to try to push a non-belief system on someone just as much as it is to push a belief system on someone. Maybe not as dangerous, but yeah. Hopefully people get my drift.
Yeah, no, well said. So there are some questions here, like Lois is asking about.
I don't think we could be able to.
No, we're not going to answer that. I'm just saying that the religious trauma syndrome and some of the things that you guys are mentioning in the comments, they're all on daretodoubt.org. Yes. And the Atheist Republic is there, like everybody, the ex-Muslims in North America, like for the Muslim page, it's actually quite comprehensive. So I think you've done a lot of really great work putting this up. And it is it's a massive.
And look, there's Ellie here on the website.
Yes. Alex, it's great. Look, that's how I think, you know, you featured my book at one point, and then, you know, I read your book and I blurbed it. I think it's just been great. We have like a tremendous mutual appreciation of each other's work. So thank you for that, by the way, Alice. I think it was really nice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Check out Dare to Doubt and please share it. Like some of the suggestions that you people are making in the live chat, I'm pretty sure it's on this website as well. So it's just like all of them in one place. So Dare to Doubt. If you do notice somebody needs help, just send them the link to Dare to Doubt, because I'm pretty sure they're going to be able to find what they need. Yeah. And we'll also include the links to both the website and also where to find Alice on social media.
Instagram and Twitter. And yeah, I hope you're incredibly.
It's articulate. In the description. But go not right now, but when we're in the public version. Go on.
Yeah, you're incredibly articulate. I think that when you express yourself, I mean, not just. You know, we're talking to you right now. I think verbally it completely matches up with the writing. Sorry. So the way when you did when you wrote the book, it was actually, you weren't just, when you were talking about your memoir, I mean, there are a lot of layers to it. And I think it was just beautifully written the way it was. Thank you. Very sort of, it was very moving, you know, the whole way that you wrote it. So I think it's an excellent book. We're really looking forward to it properly coming out.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and you totally need to talk to Susanna, because I think that would be super helpful to a lot of people. But thanks, Alice. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
It was awesome.
Yeah, it was great. So,
secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.